Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 14, Blogger and Podcaster Liability. This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audible.com/twit. And by listeners like you. Thanks for your donations. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at typicalmacuser.com/WordPress and Immigration Tales at immigrationtales.com.
Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, your host, and I'm here with a great panel of folks today to talk about blogging and podcasting and business considerations, particularly pertaining to the risks involved in those pursuits and how they can be managed. We've got really a wonderful group of folks with us here today, all of whom have a different stake in this topic. First off, we've got Carl Sussman, who is online at Carl, K-A-R-L, Sussman, S-U-S-M-A-N.com. And Carl is an insurance broker. I have that right. Broker, not agent.
Broker, agent. The license actually has both things on there. I'm an agent to some companies and a broker to others. So I guess I could be whichever one sounds better to you.
All right. All of the above then. Right. And we were laughing as we were getting on the line that that Carl is in a very intriguing branch of the insurance industry. And Carl was saying he's flattered to have any part of the insurance industry called intriguing.
But you made it sound so wonderful. You said, such an intriguing topic on the exposures and liability insurance for blogging and podcasting. All of a sudden, I was puffing up, feeling so good about it. And how exciting is this insurance topic?
Well, it is, because you are the only person I've ever encountered in my various travels through the blogosphere, podosphere, and conference sphere who actually tailors an insurance product to bloggers and podcasters. I want to get into, too, you know, how far these policies that you're tailoring reach into other kind of new media endeavors, too. But welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also on with us is Victor Caio. And Victor is a podcaster himself, a podcasting entrepreneur at thetypicalmacuser.com and also at Immigration Tales. And Victor is a very near and dear and special person to TWiL because he's also our much-loved audio engineer. So, Victor, it's great to have you in front of the microphone as opposed to behind it per usual. Thanks for coming on today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Also with us is Debbie Weil, author of The Corporate Blogging Book. You can find Debbie at debbieweil.com, D-E-B-B-I-E-W-E-I-L.com. She wrote The Corporate Blogging Book, a must-read. And also writes at least one blog. I know you write Blog Write for CEOs. Are there others that we should be aware of, Debbie?
Thank you for such a nice introduction. No, not really. That is the blog I write these days, blogwriteforceos.com.
Okay. So Debbie has been paying attention to business blogging and other new media business endeavors, including podcasting. And you do your own podcast too, do you not?
Oh, well, now I have to admit, I stopped doing it. I was doing it actually with an internet radio station where they make you pay to do it, and just dropped it. But I'm thinking of taking it up again with Blog Talk Radio, which is just looks like it's so much fun, and everybody's doing it, and of course it's free.
That's right. The only way to podcast is for free.
Yeah.
And finally, we have an old friend of mine, Kevin O'Keefe, who is the founder and president of LexBlog.com, which is a blogging platform for lawyers. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
You can find Kevin at LexBlog.com, and his blog is at Kevin.LexBlog.com. LexBlog has one of my favorite taglines of any business anywhere, and that is real lawyers have blogs.
It's also the name of the blog.
That's right. That's right, indeed. So Kevin writes frequently on issues that are not just pertinent to lawyers, but pertinent to anyone blogging in any kind of business context, and is a copious poster of links and aggregator of stories around that topic. So his blog is a great resource in that regard. So Carl, why don't we start out with you, and why don't you tell us how it occurred to you? I assume you were selling other kinds of insurance, including various kinds of business insurance. And it must have struck you one day that bloggers and podcasters needed their own flavor of this. So why don't you tell us how that happened and why that happened and how it plays out.
Well, that would have made a lot more sense if it happened that way. But I'll admit that the way I sort of fell into this was, I was doing several podcasts actually myself. And yes, I faded, and I heard Debbie did, so I don't feel so bad now. there's not this boo and hiss. But I was doing several podcasts, and it was occurring to me doing it that, you know, we're saying some things here, and we're making some representations, and we're giving advice and giving opinions, and something just didn't feel right about it. That what if somebody actually took my advice or acted on something that I said or didn't like something that I was saying? And I started looking around and reading over some of the policies that I had personally, my homeowner's insurance, my umbrella, which is excess liability insurance, and sort of looking to see, would there be coverage if somebody basically, for lack of better terminology, came after me for saying something that they didn't like? And it became evident fairly quickly that the personal insurance policies that I had were specifically excluding any type of language having to do with business or broadcast. And, you know, it's funny you had mentioned that the best way to podcast is for free, and that was one of the issues as well, was podcasters, a lot of them are they started out doing it just for fun, but of course their blog started having, you know, Google AdSense on it, or even the tip jar that people were putting on there, the PayPal tip jar. All of a sudden, even if it was, you know, small change, now all of a sudden these for fun podcasts were turning into something that you know, legally, and you know better than I, little money or a lot of money, it's still money coming in. So it was another angle that I was finding that the personal policies that most people have, whether it's a homeowner's or a condo or a renter, they have something, some form of personal liability. As an industry, we're doing a pretty good job of excluding podcasting and blogging from them.
Well, let's parse that for a second. So say you're a blogger or a podcaster, and you are simply engaged in a labor of love. Your livelihood comes from somewhere else. And you're doing this as a hobby, and you're not, you know, even having Google AdSense or a tip jar. Under those circumstances, are you pretty comfortable that people can look to their homeowners for things like coverage for defamation lawsuits, should one come their way?
They can certainly look to them, but they're not going to get coverage afforded. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Again, any type of liability that comes out of broadcast in any way, shape, or form, whether it be radio. If I was on a regular radio show and I said some things that you know, someone took as defamation, my personal liability, again, when I say that I'm speaking about anyone's homeowner or condominium or renter's policy, is not going to afford coverage for that. The fact that going forward people might actually be making some money in addition to it just gives them one more X, you know, as far as obtaining coverage, one more place where the insurance carriers specifically exclude any type of coverage for those practices.
So what about a blog, which is not a broadcast medium? I don't even know if I buy into podcasting being a broadcast medium, but you could always duke that out with your insurance carrier.
Exactly. Well, you know, like I always tell our clients, you never want to give an insurance company a good reason to not pay a claim.
Right.
And these are good reasons. And blogging has there's been a handful of cases already out there where bloggers were saying things and they were getting sued. And, you know, again, you know this better than I do. You know, a good lawsuit doesn't have to have any merit to it to cost you an awful lot of money. And again, homeowners and these personal liabilities policies are not affording coverage in any way, shape, or form for people that are getting sued for something that they have put on their blog. The only exception being, and there's always a but, there have been a handful of times when there have been reservation of rights issued on several on a policy, meaning that that a company says, well, we're not sure that this is something that's covered, but for the time being, we'll start paying some defense for it. But the long and short of it is that any type of broadcasting, and it's a very broad term, is excluded from as the standard form homeowners policy goes.
Right. You know, I mean, as I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking about the fact that none of us would walk out the door in the morning if we could, you know, conceivably get sued for everything that could possibly go wrong with our day, or, you know, all the people that could get upset with us in one form or another. And one of the ways we manage that is to have some form of insurance. I mean, most people insure their homes against fire and damage and things, but all homeowners and policies also cover some other things, you know, if someone slips and falls in your house, that sort of thing.
Sure.
So this strikes me as just an extension of that sort of risk management aspect. Is a blogging or podcasting policy, how are they priced comparable to a homeowner's policy?
They're very, very inexpensive. And, you know that's tongue in cheek, right? Saying that. But the truth of the matter is, to get, you know, a basic policy, and a basic policy is going to cover someone, let's say $1 million in coverage. You know, for depending on where in the country the policy is being issued, we're talking about maybe $400 or $500 a year. We're not talking about, you know, massive dollars to have these policies put into force.
Well, it's good to know that it's out there as an option. And how are the policies tailored so that they actually encompass your online activities?
Basically, what the policies are mirrored after, and they actually, I shouldn't say mirrored, if they are, is they're the same types of liability policy forms that are written for radio stations, for radio broadcasting stations. But the significant part is a lot of the larger stations have exclusions for personal injury. And you can, you know, if you want, I don't know how much detail you want to get in about what that really means. But the blogging and the podcasters policies do not exclude personal injury, which is really what we're all looking for to begin with.
Can you explain that? I mean, most people think of personal injury as actually, you know, getting hurt physically in some way.
Right.
But you're speaking in a broader sense, and so do the policies.
Right. I mean, I'm talking about, I go and I start a blog and a podcast, and all I do is talk about how, you know, Denise Howell is a crazy person, and you can't trust her, and she doesn't know what she's talking about, and I go on. Well, I'm obviously going to do some harm to your character, to your value, and to your livelihood.
Oh, you're the guy.
That's right. I'm the one. The mask is coming off now, you know. But seriously, and under most policies, specifically with the policies we're talking about for radio broadcasters, that type of action is excluded. Mm-hmm. Under these blogging and podcasting policies, even though it's the same form, they are not adding that exclusion on there for personal injury. So, in essence, I would have that protection afforded by the company if someone were to come after me for defaming them.
And are the blogging policies at all modeled after the publishing industry?
No, they're modeled after the radio industry.
What, and is there a reason for that choice?
That was just the route that the insurance companies were most familiar with. You know, it's difficult when you go to an insurance company that, you know, has very specific policies and products, and they're filed and they're approved with each state, and you say, okay, we're looking to cover a podcaster. And, of course, the first thing I received was a look, you know, as if I was from Mars. A what? You know, we're not insuring iPods. That was literally the first response I received when I was out there trying to get this. And, you know, take a deep breath and start from the beginning. And the closest I was able to get when I was explaining what a podcast was seemed to be a recorded radio show. That was really how they said, well, if it's a recorded radio show in some fashion, then let's look at our radio broadcasters policy and see how it may fit or may not fit. And it really grew from there. And fortunately, and you know, without getting into too many specifics, I think over time they're going to want to start adding the personal injury exclusion, because again, that's the main thing that as podcasters, the exposure that's out there is what are you saying about somebody else is really what it comes down to. And whether in what you might think is fairly benign a comment, they may not.
So defamation is personal injury in insurance speak.
Yes.
And then the other insurance speak I wanted to make sure we clarified for the users is this whole reservation of rights thing you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Back in the days when I was tendering under people's insurance policies for lawsuits where they got sued before I started doing primarily appellate law, we always wound up getting a reservation of rights. I mean, carriers never step up at the inception of some kind of dispute and say, oh, yes, there's absolutely coverage for you under this policy. Look right here in this clause. Okay. This is squarely on point. They never, ever do that. They always say, well, we'll see. In the meantime, right. we'll defend you and indemnify you, and let's see if we can't get this thing resolved in an expeditious and reasonably priced way. Mm-hmm. And so you never wind up getting that question of coverage resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something for people to bear in mind. The other thing I wanted to run through with you and the rest of our panelists is you know, the various people probably are well aware of the various things that can go wrong, and yet they still venture out onto the web every day to engage in their blogging and podcasting and everything else that people are using the web for these days. But of course, you can get into trouble for things that you do or say. You can get in trouble for things that if you are involved in some kind of a group blog or a group show, such as the one we're on right now, that your co-bloggers or your co-hosts or your co-panelists say. You could violate a blogging policy of an employer, of course, or not even a blogging policy that was designed directly or specifically to cover you. I have a few links in our discussion points about various sports entities, Major League Baseball and the NCAA, that are putting out these quote-unquote blogging policies that govern people who go to the games and you know, assert the intellectual property rights of the sports league in how any of the coverage of their event is used and whether it can be used at all. And you know, their theory seems to be that since this is not a public event per se, it's something where you buy a ticket and then you're bound by the terms of whatever the ticket provides. And if you're press and you're getting even more access through press credentials, then, you know, you're bound by whatever it is they say you can do. And of course, people have gone around and around with this over the years. Newspapers, I remember there was a sort of a seminal case involving the Masters golf tournament and the extent to which that could be covered. So I think we're crossing over into that with blogging and podcasting these days.
Mm-hmm. There's actually been a few of those I recall. I don't remember if it was that one, but there was one or two that I remember hearing about where people were, you know, they were live blogging these events, and the networks that were paying big dollars to be able to basically, you know, give coverage for those events were getting upset. They were saying, wait a minute, we're spending all this money to have, you know, the right to broadcast this event, and we have people that are sitting there, you know, basically doing the same thing, and they have a following. They're taking away from our audience.
Right. So if you continued to do that in violation of someone's policy, that would be an intellectual property violation suit coming your way, potentially.
Yeah.
We talked about defamation. It's fairly easy to defame somebody if you say something that is inaccurate and unkind about them. You could get in trouble for harassing someone if you're, again, on the too far on the unkind scale of what you do or say. And then you've got this whole other layer of liability that can come into play by what third parties do. So the commenters who come along and contribute to your blog, or the folks who call into your show or leave an audio comment. You've got limited protection for that under the law, under the Communications Decency Act. But, you know, again, it's something if you're going to set up as a business and try and manage your risks that you need to bear in mind. And the thing that's really fascinating to me is the fact that there are so often no distinct lines between what someone is doing as a blogger or a podcaster and what they are doing for their day job. You know, sometimes those are one and the same. Sometimes they're not quite one and the same. But one way or another, you can wind up saying things as a blogger or podcaster that redound to your employer in one way or another. And your employer may be all for that. Your employer may not be all for that. But then we've got this whole other level of insurance that may come into play. Because if you're speaking on behalf of a company, then presumably the company is insuring against that. Of course, now companies are just now, I think, starting to get their arms around the fact that all of the individuals in their organizations have this sort of global reach through online media. And
you get into one really interesting issue, Denise, on that when it comes to the law, because, you know, speaking with underwriters in the business, lawyers are presuming that when they're blogging, they're not actually practicing law because they don't want to create an attorney-client relationship with a client. They don't want to give legal advice for which they could be liable. So when asked, a lawyer is usually going to say, well, I'm not practicing law when I am blogging, because they don't want to have the legal liability of giving advice in that situation. Well, if they get sued, the malpractice carrier isn't going to cover those activities which are beyond the practice of law. And, you know, that's a real interesting question. If I go out and I speak at a seminar or I appear on a radio show, am I practicing law during that time if I get sued? Your malpractice carrier is probably not going to cover you. Now, if law firms can get insurance for blogging at $400 or $500, you know, Carl's going to be the busiest guy in the country. Because well, I'm going to call him this afternoon and get a policy. I'm not practicing law, but for $400 or $500, that's a lot cheaper than the quotes that I've received for getting a rider to go on my general business liability policy that covers, it gives me advertisement coverage, which then covers me publishing online and any defamation claims that come as a result of it. The other thing that you know is interesting in all of this, you've got millions of people publishing blogs, literally millions. But the lawsuits are sensational stories. They always are. The media loves to cover the sensational because it makes good discussion. So when we see these stories out here, we're seeing the real fringe. I mean, there's always the phrase that we used in the law that, you know, bad facts make bad law. Don't look at the bad facts to go out and start creating precedent and rules. And I think a lot of that pertains to blogs. There aren't the number of people getting sued for blogging, the number of people getting sued for people posting defamatory comments on blogs is infinitesimally small. The numbers are off the charts small.
Right.
Where of any law firm that's either been sued or been the subject of even an ethical grievance as it relates to a blog, when every day there's hundreds, if not, well, there's thousands of posts and thousands of comments going on.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the number of people who slip and fall are infinitesimally small too. It's just that, you know, when something bad happens, it tends to be out of proportion disaster-wise. You know, I mean, when you are that one person who gets hit with a lawsuit, it's not a good thing.
And as you know, Denise, the most important thing with the insurance isn't necessarily the coverage of a successful claim, it's the cost of defense.
Right.
If I have to go out and hire a lawyer to respond to a complaint that has been filed against me in a civil action, I'm probably going to have to pay at least $25,000 a retainer just to get an answer, to let a lawyer go on record, probably more. And so if I can tender that complaint, you know, meaning, okay, I've received a complaint, somebody sued me, forward that to my insurance company, the insurance company will assign a lawyer locally to defend that lawsuit. And now the bill for the lawyer's fees is going to be paid by the insurance company. And because the insurance company is insuring so many people that aren't getting sued and collecting premiums, it can work out as a win-win, you know, for all. So, I mean, for people out there, I wouldn't be so concerned about getting sued, you know, if you're just using your common sense. I'd be more concerned with somebody not having common sense suing me at some point in time and not having an insurance policy to cover that cost of defense.
So sitting here as an independent producer and hearing this conversation, you know, makes me want to unplug my mic, right? Because these risks are real. And I know for the kind of show that I do, where I add another layer of that, because I'm primarily talking about a specific company's product, Apple products, but I cover other products as well. And so as I started to do this for fun and for free in 2005, I can assure you none of this was even in my mind. And as the industry kind of has matured, I've had to also think about this risk management that you talked about, Denise. And my wife, who used to be an attorney, she's been on me since 2005 saying, how are we covering liability for ourselves? And finally, last year, I took on some advertisers, and that was kind of the tipping point for me in mitigating risk, because now I had yet another layer of people who could come after me. And this year, I started an LLC as a form of insurance. My wife said, at least you'll have some protection that separates assets for us, and that is going in the right direction. But I can tell you that as someone who does both a live show with live participants, it's a matter of really having control in that editorial right post-production to be able to disseminate what could get you in trouble. It can be paralyzing, I think, to the podcasting industry, because most people were like I was in 2005. They simply don't care. They want to talk about X product because they're fanboys, fangirls, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Denise.
Yes, Debbie.
Notice in the conversation, unless I missed it, and I'm trying not to do too many things here while you guys are talking, that no one has mentioned either copyright, unless I did miss it, or privacy. And I wondered if you legal minds or legal insurance minds could address that.
Well, yeah, copyright is definitely an issue that's there all the time, and it came up in our discussion of you know, covering sports events. The reason they're asserting that you can't do that is because they own the copyrights to those events. But that's certainly not the only way that you could infringe copyright as a blogger or a podcaster. You know, every time you grab an image to put in your blog post, you're facing a potential infringement claim if you haven't cleared all the rights. Every time you grab a clip of music to put in your show or play something, you know, part of a copyrighted work in a podcast, then you've got an issue there.
That reminds me actually of a really interesting point that Debbie also makes. You know, there's this whole concept of reasonable expectation of privacy. When you're running around and you're snapping a picture with your cell phone, we all know now how easy. You take a picture with your phone, you click a few buttons, it's up on the web. You can have issues with that. We were having a gathering at our house a few weeks ago, and one of my friend's wife's it sounds like he has several wives. One of the wives of one of my friends was doing something sort of funny and snapped a picture, and I snapped a picture with my phone and just sort of out of habit. I clicked the buttons, it went to Flickr, and it was there. And I shot him a link the next day, and he shot me a message back. He said, "Is this on the internet?" and I sort of chuckled. And I said, "Well, you know, yeah, I guess I really didn't think about it as being anything other than, well, now it's just in my photo collection, but yeah, I suppose it is out there now at this point." And, you know, what if that was something that you know, that he was very uncomfortable with, or she was very uncomfortable with? Maybe she was a celebrity or thought she was. Who knows? I mean, it opens up a whole can of worms, because everyone has this immediate access that they can take something that they're looking at right now and put it somewhere where literally, if someone cared enough, would be able to see immediately. And how do you quantify how many faces have seen that image? How many people have read that article? The potential, and again, you know, Denise, you know better than I, you know, to prove damages on something like that, I mean, the sky's the limit. How do you prove how many people have seen that image or read that post?
Hey, Denise, actually, well, I know I am so guilty of this myself, is, you know, capturing images or pieces of web pages as illustrations for my blog posts. How much should we be worrying about that? You know, if it has the Business Week logo in it or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you have the right to use logos for critique and commentary under the fair use protection. I mean, if you went on and Googled copyright logo corporate policy, you'll pull up a zillion corporate policies that say you can't use our logo for any purpose anywhere, any place without contacting us. Well, that's, you know, that's a nice statement, but it doesn't hold up. So if the New York Times wants to do a story on Google, they can use Google's logo in there. If you want to write a blog post about Google, you can use Google's logo. The only issue that you get into is if a reasonable person could believe that you're holding yourself out, you know, as Google or selling Google services in some regard, which is not going to happen. So, you know, when I'm posting and our clients are posting, they're routinely using the logos of institutions and organizations that they're referencing. Now, if you get into a situation where you're just going to Google Images and you do a search on something and you just take an image, yeah, you may have violated somebody's copyrights at that point in time. If you go to Flickr, the best way to do it is go into Advanced Search and click the button for Creative Commons and the further button for commercial use, because that's as broad of someone saying, go ahead and use this photograph. You may have to give attribution to the party, but that's probably going to mean just linking back to the photo at Flickr. The only issue you get in even a step further was one case where someone took a picture at Flickr, put it out there for Creative Commons so that anybody could use, which just so happened to include a young woman. The young woman didn't forego her right of privacy. And when that, I forget what that was related to. I don't know if the picture.
It was a cell phone carrier in Australia. It was Virgin.
Virgin
cell service in Australia, and they ran the ad there.
It was probably a legitimate claim. It included a person who didn't waive the right to privacy, and now Virgin was using this young woman as a nice picture to help advertise. But I think, you know, you look around the internet, people are taking images everywhere and writing free ride. Doesn't mean it's right. It does mean that the risk of somebody calling you on it is probably pretty low. And if you do get called on it, you're going to receive something that's a cease and desist. You're not going to receive something that says, you know, by the way, tomorrow you owe us $10,000 or we're going to sue you.
Right. But right of publicity and right of privacy are legitimate concerns for you as a blogger or a podcaster using images of people, because they certainly can come back to bite you. You know, in most public settings, the right of privacy doesn't apply, but I was intrigued because people are out in public and the law, which is all about reasonable expectations when it comes to privacy, assumes that people know when they're out in public they can be photographed and that things may be done with those photographs. But the example that Carl gave where folks are, you know, in their own home having a gathering of friends, that's something a little bit different. Someone whips out a camera, you know, is your reasonable expectation that that photo is going to instantly be on the internet? I guess it depends who you are and who your friends are. So, and you know, as Kevin mentioned, this comes up a lot when it comes to minors. We had an episode of my son's preschool where one of the moms was taking, you know, adorable pictures of our kids in class and putting them up on Shutterfly. And, you know, some of us thought that was just fantastic. And I think it was even, you know, not a publicly available space, but just a space that was invite only. But some of the parents just freaked. And
but Denise, did they have the names, first and last name of the children on the pictures or not?
No, but again, you know, that's something you might well do without thinking about it. So, you know, that it's just a question of there's a lot of potential holes to step in that you can easily breeze right by. And I agree with Kevin that if you don't breeze right by them and you manage to step in them and get yourself in trouble, that a lawsuit is probably not the first thing that's going to happen, but it's the last thing you want to deal with.
Well, and now it's going well beyond just still pictures. People are pulling up Ustream and they're streaming from every location, every conference. You know, it's nothing to put something up on YouTube. And so it really extends well beyond, because now you are oftentimes at private events where people are opening their laptop and literally streaming live video and audio from these events. So it opens up to another layer of liability. And I think most people don't even give it a second thought. They're out there in their space you know, talking to their tribe.
Right, and to get back
you've
to
seen
the
quick,
quick, yes,
thank
absolutely,
you. Thank you.
Yeah, quick. Now people are literally streaming from their cell,
from their phone. Yeah,
right.
And it's hysterical because if you ever get really bored, you go on to and you look at what they're streaming. It's not like they're streaming typically anyway. Anything terribly interesting. It's just, you know, it's for the nerds and all of us that like to be able to, just the idea that they can hold up their phone and it's live streaming. On the internet. They just think it's really cool. But you're absolutely right.
That's right. It's like when webcams first came into being, mm-hmm. and you would log on and go, "Whoa, there's a camera at the zoo," or maybe elsewhere.
Where does that change, though, Denise? So that pretty soon, like you said about public, we're in public, and we presume that we don't have a privacy. When does this technology then take over and become so ubiquitous that, hey, you can't presume you're not being filmed by XYZ person for YouTube at any time?
That's right. Well, you know, as we were saying, privacy law is all about what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. So, you know, if you're in a restroom with the door closed and someone manages to upskirt you or, you know, otherwise take an embarrassing photo, then of course your expectation of privacy has been violated. But courts are going to have to grapple with that in their face, I think, over the next 5-10 years as these technologies become more and more ubiquitous.
There's actually a case I think I forgot to send this around. It's my mistake because I had it in a PDF versus a web link. But there's a case right now against Google and a private party specifically for this. I should have sent this to you. I guess it's a little late now, but it's exactly what we're talking about with YouTube. It was a cease and desist order because of something that was put up and the person didn't want it there. And this was filed February 4th of this year.
Right. I mean, the number of those sorts of lawsuits that Google gets hit with, they have just a legion of lawyers sifting through those mm-hmm. and managing them. So one thing I want to get back to is this question of, okay, so there are risks out there. We want to try and manage them as best we can. If you're an individual, you can go to Carl and pay your $400 or $500 a year and gain some level of protection that helps you. But say you're someone who's blogging either loosely or tightly on behalf of your company. You know, to what extent can you look to them? And, you know, Carl, how do you broker that relationship?
Well, it's an interesting question. So you're talking about an individual that is blogging about a company that they work for or on behalf of that company, I suppose, more likely.
Sure. Sun Microsystems has 4,000 bloggers. Microsoft has 1,000.
Right. It's going to depend on how aggressive, the person that's unhappy with the post is going to be, I suppose. But again, if they're going to name the person who posted the blog and they're going to name the employer that they're working on behalf of, and again, you know better than I how that all comes to fruition with regard to the individual. Are they still going to have somebody appear on their behalf? I think the answer is yes. And I can tell you again that there's the individual carrier, the personal lines policies that everyone already has is not going to send, you know, that attorney in this, you know, coat tie with a briefcase to represent them for something having to do with an online blogging post. It just doesn't happen.
Are you tailoring in your efforts to sell this product? Are you tailoring your pitch to individuals or to businesses or some combination thereof?
Well, you know, it's neither really. And the truth is, it's not something that I'm actually out there aggressively trying to push. It's something that I, you know, sort of put together, you know, like I said, accidentally because I found the need for myself. But, you know, if I'm working for Microsoft and I'm one of their bloggers, am I going to be uncomfortable without insurance for myself for the posts I'm making? I don't know. I probably wouldn't be. I mean, I would figure, you know what, I'm working for them and my blog is, you know, it's a Microsoft, you know, blog, blah, blah. I wouldn't be terribly concerned. But as an individual without that large corporate, you know, large corporate dollars protecting me, if there is someone that comes after me, I would be concerned, and I was.
Yeah.
Carl, okay, on that very point, can you talk about the Cisco employee who, it turns out, is an attorney, mm-hmm. who is now being sued? He had a quote-unquote private, actually even anonymous blog.
That's an important distinction because it's private now. It's invitation only now. It was public before, but he was anonymous.
Can you talk about that for us non-legal types?
Me?
But what the, well, whoever, Carl or Denise, I mean, what explaining, because that's being written up as, you know, this shows that great risks in corporate blogging and look out for employee blogging and, you know, see the legal risks. But what would be your take on this particular case?
Well, I haven't seen it, and obviously Denise is going to have a better opinion on the legalities of it. But as far what I could tell you is that if this is referencing an employee, was he blogging something on behalf of the employer, or was it, or what was the relationship?
Now, it's an interesting case. His name was Frankel, Richard or Stephen, I forget what his first name was.
Yep.
But he was blogging anonymously, and he wrote a blog called the Patent Troll Blog. And the interesting thing about his blog and the fact that he worked for Cisco is that he and Cisco were very much of the same mind as to patent trolls. In other words, they didn't like them. And patent trolls are people who, you know, acquire a vast portfolio of patents and, you know, don't actually expend creative energy, just go around enforcing their rights and extracting licensing agreements from...
It's very lucrative from what
yes,
I do.
Exactly. So the patent troll tracker was out there anonymously identifying those sorts of activities, and where he crossed the line and got himself in a bit of hot water, both legally and with his employer, is he commented on a suit that was pending by a patent troll against Cisco, and said some things that got him and I think... Cisco, yes, because he said that his immediate manager knew about his blogging, so got them both sued, and I think that is still pending. And Cisco has actually altered its blogging policy as a result to specify that if you're blogging about the company in any way, you may not do so anonymously, and you must say that it's your own opinion and not the opinion of the company.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I think that's another example, Debbie, of those real extreme cases where we had the anonymity, which really upset people, because some of these patent claims are legitimate. So somebody goes out and is an inventor, patents something, they may not use the patent, so the larger companies get ticked off that nobody's using the patent, other than they're now extracting royalties from a company like Cisco, when Cisco wants to use the processor procedure. And this party not only was doing it anonymously, ripping on the lawyers and the people that were doing this, but, you know, may have even stepped over the line and, you know, defamed somebody. And when you're doing it anonymously and really aligning yourself with your employer, you know, you're really holding Cisco out there. Cisco has an interest in this thing. And I think Cisco at the end of the day was looking at it saying, this doesn't do us any good from a PR standpoint. Have people out there ripping on people, not disclosing that they're associated with the company. It's just a bad PR deal all the way around for Cisco. So Cisco, that does want to allow blogs, just came out and said, well, let's use a little bit of common sense here. Let's realize that if people are going to get into that situation, they disclose that they're blogging, you know, that they're an employee of Cisco, and let's be open about the positions that they have, and we're not going to allow people to be anonymous. Whether that claim survives at the end of the day, you know, I don't know. But there you have a real shoving match between people that are a little bit ticked off at each other, so that lawsuit may continue for a while. But that's just because it became so inflammatory between the parties. You know, as far as that affecting most companies, I don't see it. You know, I think a lot of common sense, you know, when you look at Microsoft's blog policy and you look at Sun Microsystems' blog policies, you know, both companies promoting the use of blogs so that their people can collaborate with the outside world and build relationships with people that can give them knowledge and collaborate with them on products that could be coming out and whatnot. You know, their number one rule is be smart. You know, and then they provide certain other procedures that really are not rocket science. You know, don't disclose intellectual capital of the company. Well, do that. You know, don't go out and defame somebody. You know, the common sense things that you wouldn't do over the telephone, or you wouldn't do in a letter, or you wouldn't do at a conference, tend to be the same things that I see in the corporate blogging policies. The things that the employees need to be aware of are that, you know, you have the right to free speech. That's correct. You can say what you want. You just don't have the right to a job. So, if if an employer wants to dismiss somebody for any reason, including that they don't like the fact that they wear red shoes every day, they can do so in most every state because the employee is an employee at will unless they have a contract or there's some employee, you know, agreement that says they can only be dismissed, you know, with just cause or due cause. But most don't have that type of protection. Most employers are going to have something in place that says everybody's an employee at will. So if somebody goes out and blogs, unbeknownst to their employer, or says things that are contrary to the employer's, you know, position on things, they're at risk to getting fired. They can't come back and say, hey, it's a free country, I can say what I want to say. Well, you can say what you want to say, but you don't have the right to a job.
Well, you know the old saying, you can do whatever you want to do on your last day at that company. I won't tell you which. There's a large company that we all know. I won't say the name because I don't want to get in trouble for it. That's actually in their corporate papers. You can do whatever you want to do on your last day here.
I like that.
Denise, I had a quick thought on the corporate blogging policies, which I researched, of course, for my book and also interviewed you, I think. Just two things really struck me. This is Debbie speaking, by the way. One was that common sense basically seemed to cover it, but maybe common sense, maybe we don't have enough of it. And the second thing was fear, just fear on the part of the companies that there's more fear about expression, and I think you were the one who talked to me about this, or there was some lawyer I talked to. There's more fear about expression online, even if you know what you can say and what you can't say about your company, than offline. So even though you know what you should not say to a reporter, and of course probably wouldn't do it in a phone call, and the company trusts most employees, even high-level employees especially, not to do that, there's more fear about them doing it online and, you know, you push publish or something. And of course, actually, there is some justification for that fear because of the viral nature of whatever gets posted online and because Google makes everything findable. So it's interesting, I think.
What are you finding, Debbie, when you're dealing with, you know, I'm dealing with law firms that are, they make their money by dealing with fear and taking a more conservative, I mean, it's true. I mean, I practiced law for 17 years. Our role when advising people is to be risk adverse. Don't do those things that can create any liability. And if there isn't enough plus side, don't take action. So when law firms are dealing with it, you know, some of them will have quality and assurance committees, you know, that'll be 17 deep and they have to reach a consensus on everything they do. So one person may say, you know, I don't understand a whole lot about blogs, and I read this story about Cisco, and I don't want to be in that type of situation, so we're just not going to allow blogs. Now, at some point, they will, because that same firm may not have used email, because they were concerned that people could have intercepted confidential information, but now they do. But I'd be curious as to what you're seeing just out there in general corporate America, because you are raising the same issue, that people know what they can do and not do. May feel more comfortable when they're out in seminars where there isn't a digital recording stored at Google and text. So I'm curious as to what you see in corporate America.
Well, I'm still seeing the fear. And of course, someone mentioned this earlier that, wait a minute, you know, you're at a seminar. You have no idea who's live blogging it, who's recording it, and where that's going and where those files are going. So basically, privacy, I mean, I think everyone agrees that privacy just doesn't exist anymore. So you have to be very careful. But of course, you can also, if it's big companies, we're talking about their own blogs, they can control, and this is what I talk to them about, and then they quickly get this part, that you can control what you blog, of course, and you can completely control the comments from your readers that you publish because you look at them ahead of time and just don't publish the ones that you don't want to publish. So there's more control than they realize certainly in using blogging technology.
Do Debbie or Kevin, do any of the people you consult with, you know, as their online media consultant, are they podcasting and are any of them doing anything that's live or nearly live?
For me, just particular clients I have right now, no, but, you know, doesn't. Kevin? It's just, you know, the other number one, this fear is the number one issue I run against. The number two, again, when we're talking even about bigger companies, is time, just time. That's part of their fear is, you know, they don't have a separate staff for blogging or for podcasting. So, you know, who's going to do it and how are they going to fit it in? And I just actually, as we started on the hour, I saw Actually, I got an email and a press release went out that Kodak has named a chief blogging, they're calling it, I don't know if it's chief blogging, all of it, chief blogger. So they're, and they've
the chief
issued
blogger.
A press release about it. So they've, in other words, they've given this person, that's going to be her job title. But that's very much the exception.
Right. Cisco has that as well. In fact, I just saw their chief blogging person speak at a conference last week.
We have people that are podcasting. I don't think that any of them are doing it live mm-hmm. that I know of. They may appear live on other people's internet broadcast shows, but their own podcasts are recorded and then available to be downloaded by RSS.
Editable. I'm somewhat stunned given the cautious nature of we lawyers in general that you have a client base, but you have a burgeoning one. Which
I think it's an education thing. I mean, I think Debbie's right. I mean, I think you see Debbie out there every day. I think we have to talk about blogs and be evangelists for them, because as my creative director said, he said, just keep talking the same message until my great aunt can explain it back to you. And I think that's a little bit of that's right, is to take the analogies out there that people have had some success, characterize them into a situation where your clients may be, and to start to bring a comfort level to them. We're dealing with one large law firm right now where lawyers are clamoring to blog because one of their lawyers had such extraordinary success that another law firm came along and pilfered them and took them away because they wanted the book of business that person had created. So now they have two or three more lawyers mm-hmm. now that are ready to blog, and the law firm is bogged down in this quality and assurance committee, which we're meeting next week with 14 or 15 people on a conference call, and they want somehow us to assure them that nothing could ever happen, which of course we can't. I think it has to be one of those things that I think if you went out and asked someone like Debbie, gee, are there benefits from blogging in a corporate sense? Well, sure there are. To build relationships, to increase the network, to begin to collaborate with other people, to improve what you're doing in your business, to improve the level of your services so you're getting feedback, from the marketplace, from the customers, to put a voice on the company. All those are just really positive things. Now, in life, when we take some action, there's always going to be pluses and minuses. And here there's going to be, there's some risk. Let's put things in place like Debbie just described. Take baby steps. As the posts go up, let somebody else see it and filter it. And then start to get comfortable with it. And then that bringing in a blogging officer is going to be really important because you need to bring somebody inside these companies that they develop a relationship of trust with as an employee that actually understands what the blogosphere is all about, because it's very foreign to people. They can't understand this idea of engaging in an online conversation with other thought leaders and with the marketplace and how free-flowing that can be. It's not just writing articles. It's not just issuing press releases that the company may be familiar with.
No, I was just saying, I think Kevin, he hit on something really key there, which is that most people, they're not familiar enough with this whole this blogging medium to really understand what it means. I mean, I still get people that will ask every day, well, what exactly is a blog? And what's this podcast? I mean, they do. And we all kind of snicker and go, but we're still in the very much in the minority in all of this.
Well, I was just going to say the opposite, that I'm sure that we are. And people who are blogging and podcasting are in the minority as to the greater public. But blogging has been around for a long time, podcasting a slightly shorter time. And I think we're getting to a point with those media where your great aunt might be able to start explaining it back to you pretty soon. but now, we mentioned Twitter earlier. I think these mm-hmm. the various other and more instantaneous even media and much more unfiltered and unedited that are available and starting to become wildly widespread. And I'm wondering, Carl, if your policies or your clients are dealing with that at all yet. So I guess the question is, there's blogging and there's podcasting. There are a whole host of other online communication tools.
Sure.
Wikis, Twitter.
Message boards.
Yes.
And all sorts of, you're right. I mean, it's where do you, I don't know exactly where the line will be drawn. At some point it'll be drawn somewhere, but these are, it all comes back to the same concept. It's like you're saying, it's, what's a reasonable, you want to be reasonable with the things you're saying, regardless of if you're speaking them in a podcast, you're posting them on a blog, you're in a, you know, a message board, or you're in a what do they call it? You know, those little support forums. I've been on a lot of support forums when I'll have a product and I'll be trying to figure something out. And you read some of the things people say. You know, you get a particular cell phone or PDA and you're having problems. You go to the support forum, won't say any names, and you search for, you know, the problem you're having, and people are just chewing it apart. Ah, oh, this piece of, you know what, it keeps doing blah, blah, blah. And I'm reading that and I'm thinking, well, I just bought it and that's my problem. Maybe I shouldn't have this thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I could be making a return or, you know, decision based on what someone is putting in that company's own support form. Now, am I going to be held liable for, would that person be held liable in essence for saying something negative about a particular product from a particular company on their own support form? Denise, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, a company is going to have an obligation to moderate what's going on.
Yes.
On its support forums. And, you know, if they can flip a switch and turn off any comment that they don't like. But, you know, conceivably, they could go after somebody participating in their own forum for defamation, I guess. I don't see that would ever realistically happen.
But the point is made that it's a powerful communication medium again. And this isn't somebody's individual blog. It's not for their company. They're not doing it. They're going to X company support, you know, page to try and gather information. And there's a lot of, you know, I don't think it's unique to any one particular company.
And again, just expressing a negative opinion isn't ever defamation. It's when you say something that's false and harmful.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think some companies are very much more proactive about monitoring that. You know, for example, a computer company that shall remain unnamed, you'll often see those kinds of comments there one day, and they're simply gone. And then you see comments about it being gone. So I think, you know, I think the companies vary as far as, you know, how closely they're monitoring that, and they're kind of looking after their brand from that perspective. Although the users might take real offense to them doing that.
Carl, do you write policies for businesses that have multiple employees that are covered by the policy?
Absolutely. I mean, this particular product that, you know, we've spoken about that for bloggers or podcasters is, mm-hmm. is one small, you know, niche product. But we have a full, you know, the office here, we write everything. We'll write the entire business exposure. We'll write the podcasting if that's part of it. We'll write a policy on a business that includes podcasting or blogging if they have, you know, 200 employees or 10 or whatever it might be.
Right. So I'm a business and I've got a bunch of employees and I want them to blog and I'm trying to manage the risks of that. And I come to you and I say, and our employees are also active Twitter users and use all kinds of other things. How can I make sure that the policy covers their activities in those arenas, or can
all of those things would be covered in this one endorsement, which is in addition to a policy, which is going to cover media for broadcast media. And that's something that can be added on to, you know, a law office policy all the way to we have an architect firm locally that we insure. And obviously that's, you think, well, where's the broadcasting exposure there? But one or two of the artists there, they have their own little blogs, and you know they'll ask the clients, do you mind if, you know, I'll put the sketches we're doing online, we'll work on it together. And the clients of course sign off and say, sure, that's fine. But they came to me and they said, you know, we're worried, you know, what if somebody, you know, looks at this drawing and then sends an email, says, you know, our firm could do a better job at this for you, that firm isn't good, blah, blah, blah. It's not, you know, it's again, it's all a matter of, you know, what's the cost value, you know, what's the value based on the cost. It's so inexpensive to pick up a policy that's going to protect against all of that. You know, we insured the entire operation for the firm, and we just added that on for broadcasting as well.
So, Carl, the thing that I'm recalling about insurance policies is that they tend to want to handle things that are accidental, and when something happens that was done intentionally, that's often a basis for excluding providing a defense and or coverage.
Right. Well, that's a good point. And, you know, with policies that are covering tangible things, the buzz phrase is, you know, physical, immediate, and accidental. And with this, again, you're right. No one is accidentally typing something out. Where it becomes an issue is, are they specifically writing something with the specific intent to cause harm? It's one thing if I want to sit and say, you know, again, that, you know, Denise is this crazy person, blah, 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 and she doesn't know what she's doing, and on, and don't use her ever, whatever you do, you cross a line where you're specifically trying to inflict harm to the subject that we're talking about. And, you know, and again, because it's a broadcast policy, I've yet to see one, and I should knock on wood here, I don't want to curse myself. I've yet to see any kickback from the insurance carriers saying that, you know what, this was a deliberate act. You know, again, it's like the bar fight. Where does the first punch turn from self-defense to he was just drunk and it was, you know, he didn't have control versus, you know, he went, bought a bat at Target, drove to the bar, looked for this guy and attacked him with it. You know, where do you draw the line between what was accidental and immediate versus what was planned with explicit intent for harm?
Right. So it's not something you can absolutely, there will be a line drawn, in other words.
I suspect at some point there'll be a line that's drawn. I've yet to actually see it happen. I think we're probably a few years away before we get to something like that. But again, I think I did send you a copy of the policy way back when I first saw you over at the New Media Expo maybe a year ago.
You did, and I still want to read it.
Goodness, I'm not crazy. So you've got it. Okay.
I do.
I'd love to get your take on it.
Yeah, I'd love to go through it. Well.
Apparently you don't want it too badly.
Carl, I received
the same thing. I requested it and received a copy of a policy from the Hartford. And, it sat on my shelf for a long time.
It's hard to make
really. It was really long.
That's why people like insurance brokers are so important, because people tend to just, you know, listen to the summary of what's in the policy and not get down into the nuts and bolts. Most of them are just so difficult to read, and you wind up, you know, with things like personal injury covering things that you would never, in common parlance, think of as a personal injury.
So, well, you know, let's face it, this is not an exciting thing to sit and peruse through. You know? And when we were looking, I was looking at some of the articles that we were passing around that we were going to discuss today, and, you know, my eyes start glazing over after a while, you know, when I'm reading about this, that, and the other, and all these different cases that are out there. And insurance policies are not super exciting either to read. Fortunately for me, because I've read so many of them, a lot of them are boilerplate, and I'm relatively good at quickly going through and finding the things that are unique to that particular endorsement or that particular policy. So if someone's going to come and say, well, will it cover XYZ? If it's something really bizarre, I'll remember having seen that as being included or excluded. If not, you know, you go and you check. I mean, you can search PDF files so quickly now. It is so much easier than it used to be to have to go and double check things and policies, let me tell you.
Denise, if it's not too far off topic, what about the other side, the equipment capital investment side of, you know, the podcaster? Is that solely covered under a home policy, or would a policy like this be needed because you've expensed, you know, X amount of money on podcasting equipment?
I think
Victor,
the latter.
Cha-ching, 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 Victor, it's what a lovely little segue for me. Most homeowners policies have a limit for what's considered business property that's in the house. And again, these policies can, and most people get some type of limited amount of coverage for their stuff. You know, again, I remember being at the New Media Expo, and you're looking at some of this recording equipment, and it's unbelievable, you know, the amount of money you can spend if you really want to get some really, you know, good equipment for recording. Now, Victor, of course, in this call, he sounds better than all of us. He probably has got the best equipment, you know, and you can tell because that's what he does. I would suspect that he has spent more money and has more stuff in his house for this type of thing than the average Joe. And yeah, his policy at his home would probably max out at a couple $1,000s, and that would be it.
You can tell us, Victor. You can tell us how much you've dropped. We won't tell your wife.
Yeah, well, Victor and I have something in common. We both had our wives push us to find out about exposures for podcasting in general. That was my wife that was coming to me saying, the first podcast I did way back when, it was a funny little thing where we just took emails of people's questions and we answered them. And she came, she goes, what if somebody listens to you? What if somebody actually, and I'm thinking you mean, well, I know you don't, but let's just say somebody actually listened to what I was suggesting. And I sort of scratched my head and I said, gosh, you know, you're right. Let's find out about that. So Victor and I both have our wives to thank for that worry seed that was planted.
Denise, as long as we're talking about our spouses, which I guess people don't normally do, my husband was the inspiration for the first line in my book, which it echoes Kevin's new tagline. And the first line in my book is, real people don't blog. And then I go on to say, well, explain, of course, that they do. But certainly when my book was published in 2006, that's what most people thought, that this was not something done by business people. So just thought that was kind of interesting. Spouses can be helpful. He inspired me to gave me the idea for how to write the introduction. So but I guess I think real people do blog is what we're finding.
Yeah, I think more and more real people do. Or if they don't blog, you know, I think it was Carl's homepage at carlsussman.com I was looking at, where, Carl, you are into everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got your Vox blog, you've got your Tumblr, you've got your Facebook.
You've got too.
Yeah.
I was just trying to make look pretty what's at the bottom of your email signature, which is the same blue links are going right down there.
Wow.
But, you know, you mentioned that, and I want to just throw this out, you know, real quick. If anyone is interested in getting information on the insurance portion, they won't find it at my personal blog, which is the carlsussman.com that we've mentioned. It's actually at my company's blog, which is sussmaninsurance.com.
Right. But if you click on insurance at carlsussman.com, you're writing an insurance blog there too.
Right. But you still stay sort of in the window for my personal blog, and it takes you to my corporate blog where I just have news and insurance updates. So you got to really dig if you want to get from my personal blog to the business side, which was actually by design. I figure people that are going to be interested in following me on Twitter or looking at the shots I shouldn't be posting on Flickr are probably not the same people that are going to want to find out about insurance from me.
So do you have an insurance policy for yourself that covers your insurance blog at carlsussman.com?
And I absolutely do. I absolutely do.
And that's,
it'll cover me if I start podcasting again as well.
And do you have a CGL that would be a commercial general liability policy for your insurance business?
Of course. Absolutely. I practice what I preach.
Yes. So do you see any overlap between those two things potentially?
Not really. You know, it really just depends on the nature of a potential claim that's coming to me. You know, my thing is, you know, I'd rather be a little extra conservative than have to have a company come back and say, you're on your own with this. And, you know, again, we're not talking about large dollars. And I think that's been one of the interesting points. If I had a radio station, a full-blown, you know, tower, you know, blah, 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 they pay, as you can imagine, a lot of money. We've got a couple of those insured. But you're getting that same policy form for the little guy at home. It's actually pretty amazing that they've been able to scale them down so small and keep the same coverage.
Which company is it, Carl?
Well, they haven't really given me the green light to blow it out to the world at this point, and I think they're afraid of getting too much too quick. But it's one of the name brand carriers that, you know, everyone's familiar with that's out there.
Because it is. I mean, it's because I've been asked about it and mm-hmm. talked about it, and I've told anybody if they can get insurance for anything, it's the best deal you can ever buy. I mean,
sure.
Why not buy insurance and then not have to worry about things? You know, still be smart. Nobody wants to have a claim brought against them, but in the unlikely event a claim is bought, you've gone out there and bought insurance, and that's just the cost of doing business.
I think that's really the big part of it, is everyone has to start realizing that, you know, yes, just because we're sitting at home and we're doing something, it doesn't mean that we're not potentially doing something, you know, very large in the large scheme of things that are, you know, people have online businesses all the time, and we have insurance for that as well. People don't realize it. That they're selling things from home, they're making. I have someone that makes perfume. You ready for that? I don't even want to know how she does it, but she manufactures and bottles and sells her own perfume. And she was just sort of doing it. And she came to me and for her personal insurance, for her car insurance, I think it was. And when I found out what she did, after being shocked, I said, "Well, I hope you have insurance for that." And she sort of looked at me and she said, "Well, I never really thought about that." And this is perfume. I mean, someone could get it in their eye. Who knows what's even in this stuff? And hopefully she's not listening. But, you know, I guess people have to sort of realize that you, with this new internet global market, blah, blah, you know, the world is getting smaller, et cetera, that the little things that we do can have large risks associated with them.
So, Kevin, as I'm listening to you talk about your clients and how they approach this, it occurs to me that law firms – or lawyers operating as a business probably need to at least be thinking about having three forms of insurance: their regular liability policy, their malpractice policy, and if they are engaged in any of these online endeavors we've been discussing, perhaps a podcasting policy and a blogging policy on the insurance front. And I'm remembering back in the deep, dark archives of your posts that you had some discussion about some malpractice carriers that just, I don't know, they just weren't getting blogging, or they just looked at it and said, that's not a risk we want to be involved in at all. And they weren't they refusing to cover lawyers who were blogging, or am I missing that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It was Chubb Insurance, and a lawyer in New Jersey asked their agent, would we have coverage if we were blogging?
I think any kind of malpractice coverage.
Right, that's correct. And they said, no, we will not free your firm at all. We're going to be blogging. So that broke out into the blogosphere, and it created an uproar. And it was very interesting. Even the National Law Journal couldn't get a response from Chubb when they wanted to report on the story. But by me going out and creating a list of all of the comments that lawyers had made on the subject and sending a copy of that post to the press people at Chubb, you know, they issued a press release within another two business days saying, basically, never mind. It was, we will not insure those firms which give specific advice on their blogs to specific fact situations. But as to other types of blogs, we will cover the firms. Well, what the lawyers basically said was, we've never seen a law firm have a blog in which they would give specific advice to specific fact situations, because that would open up a whole lot of issues as far as ethics were concerned, that the lawyers would never go down that road.
So what they were thinking was, I can't believe an attorney would do this for free online, just post something.
I think it really was, in fairness to Chubb. I mean, they took a beating very quickly on it all online, but in fairness to them, they just were not, I think, that familiar with what blogs were and how they would be used by an insurance company. So when you're hearing something that's probably...
You mean by a law firm?
Yeah, by a law firm. I mean, you know, they may be hearing them say, gee, would you provide coverage to us if our lawyers are spending their time on MySpace during the day rambling on about anything? And they'd probably say, well, that sounds nuts. You know, you may be creating a diary online where you're going to be talking about what you just talked to a client about. There was a managing partner in a pretty significant law firm that went and knocked on a lawyer's door who was bringing in huge amounts of work from very sophisticated clients on insurance coverage issues via his blog, and said, you know, if I wanted to go to the blog, and I'm not saying I do, how would I go and find it? And then the other question was, I hear this is a diary that you're keeping online. Do you diary about your conversations that you have with our clients? And so there we had a lawyer in the firm where one of the biggest rainmakers in the firm was bringing in work by virtue of their blog, and yet they had no idea of what this creature even was that they heard was a blog. So in fairness to Chubb, I think it may have been that type of original perception, and they did respond very, very quickly, a matter of 4 or 5 days, and clarify their position and did say they would cover blogs in general. And I think that happened, though, because of the blogosphere. I mean, the lawyers, to get in an uproar and get out there and report on the issue, brought it to a head where Chubb had to establish a response. I did some research. I couldn't find anything else out there, Denise, on that subject. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been a situation where it's been talked about between a law firm and their malpractice carrier. I asked my readers, you know, if they were aware of any situations, and I didn't receive, you know, any responses. So it looks like blogging per se, you know, hasn't excluded a firm from malpractice coverage. But like you said, it may not provide the coverage that they need. So that if blogging were considered to be part of their marketing activities and they went out and defamed somebody, defamation would usually be covered under your general liability policy. So when I was practicing law, I had an insurance company sue me for defamation for posting an ad in a newspaper requesting information on a lawsuit. So they sued me for defamation, and I tendered it to both my malpractice carrier and my general liability carrier, and the general liability carrier covered the lawsuit, which was ultimately dismissed. But the point was that it was covered under advertising, and defamation was under that. Now today, under general liability policies, there's usually going to be an exclusion for advertising and defamation, and then you've got to go in and buy the rider to get that type of coverage, and maybe even blogging coverage, like you're saying, you know, even in addition to that.
And the one thing I think it's important to for folks to recognize is if they do hope to have any kind of coverage under their existing personal insurance, you know, as Carl was saying at the beginning of the show, the moment that it crosses over into a business endeavor in any way, you're going to be out of luck if you haven't taken care of this in one way or another. So,
and the insurance companies are a lot smarter today about excluding these things from coverage. I mean, when I found the internet in 1995 or 1996, just like someone else mentioned here, I started answering questions on American Online on legal issues, not giving specific legal advice, putting a disclaimer up, but I just answered questions, 4 to 7 a day. The issue came up, you know, in the firm, should we ask our malpractice carrier or our carrier about it? And I said no, because they're immediately going to say no, there's not going to be any coverage for it. But under the language that I'm reading the policies, I think there arguably is. So if it's I feel comfortable that if I ever did get sued, and I didn't think I would be, and I never was, that there would have been coverage. Now, today, I think if I open that policy, because everybody is very familiar with the Internet and how people communicate, there would be specific provisions that would relate to the Internet and would probably exclude coverage for doing that type of thing.
Of course. All right. Well, folks, I need to take a little break in the action here to thank our sponsor, Audible.com, and give you some information about how you can sign up and get a free audiobook if you are not already an Audible listener. If you go to audible.com/twit, you can sign up and get a free book, any of the books of their vast catalog, which are not only books, but podcasts and magazines and lecture series and all sorts of wonderful material there. And if you spend as much time running around in your car as I do, you are a huge Audible fan already. And if you are not yet a fan, here's a way that you can get involved and give a listen to some of the great stuff they have there. There's also a way, if you'd like, if you want to sign up for their subscription plan, which is you pay a small fee every month and then you get a certain amount of downloads that you can go ahead and put on your iPod or any other listening device and take with you wherever you may be. If you are not already a subscriber and you go to audible.com/twit749, you get half off 3 months of a subscription membership and you get a book credit each of those months. So those are two great ways to get involved with Audible if you are not already there. And Debbie, I looked for your book to put as our Audible pick this week, but unfortunately, it's not on there.
What should I do about that?
I don't know. I guess get in touch with Audible and tell them they should have your book. I would certainly love to be able to recommend that one. But failing that, I did find a book that is sort of pertinent to our subject matter here that is called The Small Business Bible by Stephen D. Strauss. Which covers things like all the various questions that you have, including how to manage risks. So that's my business-related pick for the day. And since so many of our listeners are both business people and parents, I have my parent-related pick too. And this is one that we've been giving a lot of exercise in the car lately with my son. All of Beverly Cleary's wonderful books, and if anyone is of my
bonus series
generation at all, you guys will remember these from when you were kids. The Mouse and the Motorcycle, Ralph S. Mouse, all of those are available on Audible too, and they make for a great listen in the car as you're driving around if you're trying to keep your kids off those video screens that we're starting to see more and more of, and give them something great to listen to and imagine. Then this is a great way to go. So we thank Audible for their support, and I thank all of you for coming on the show today. This was fascinating, and I hope we haven't scared too many people or made them think that they should have agoraphobia and never leave the house and never do a podcast and never write a blog because it's just too risky. Of course, that's not the case. There are ways of managing those risks, and I think you guys have helped shed some great light on both what can happen and why it shouldn't be so big a concern that it renders you motionless.
This living business, it's just dangerous, isn't it?
That's right. Victor, I'm so thrilled that we were able to have you on the show today. Is there anything on your plate you want to alert our listeners to or plug before we sign off?
Just if you are a Mac user or just Mac curious, come over to typicalmacuser.com and we'll teach you some stuff.
Absolutely. Victor's show is a must listen for all of the Mac loyal folks out there. And that's, you know, pretty much everyone these days.
It's definitely me, Victor. I'll be over there soon because I'm sitting here on my MacBook Air. So I can't wait to visit.
Debbie, you're now the second person I've had on the show who has an Air. Oh, I'm sure Victor does too.
I don't. You need one. You need one, Denise, definitely.
I do need one. I hate traveling. Right? I love, you know, having my PowerBook with me, but
you have a third now, Denise.
Oh, wow. All right, I'm gonna set up a little fund for buy Denise an Air.
if you're single and a male, you know, and about 25 years old, they attract more people at a conference than a golden retriever puppy.
what do I do if I'm not single and 25 and a male?
Yeah, that's my problem. I mean, everybody came up and, you know, can I touch your Mac Air? Can I look at this thing? This is amazing.
I hope nobody tried to test out its aerodynamic frisbee qualities. Does look like it would lend itself to that. Kevin, it's great to have you on the show. I've been meaning to do that for a while. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate the opportunity, and keep up the good work you're doing, because you're one of the people that covers an awful lot of areas, both tangential to the law, that reaches out into the new media industry.
Thanks so much. And you too. I love your blog, and folks should check it out at kevin.lexblog.com. Real lawyers have blogs. Carl, so informative. Thank you for joining us and shedding light on podcasting and blogging insurance and insurance for all of your online doings, including tweeting and Wikipediaing and anything else.
Woo-hoo. Thank you. No, I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure. And I hope we don't bring down your poor insurance site's server with folks beating a path to your door.
Oh, that would be a terrible problem. Incidentally, I'm happy if anyone does have any specific and or general questions about, you know, what may or may not be covered on, you know, something generally. They want to shoot me an email, if they want to post something on the blog, that's fine. I'm happy to answer any general questions like that as well, with a disclaimer, of course.
What's your email?
It's just my name, Carl, K-A-R-L, at Sussman Insurance, S-U-S-M-A-N, insurance, all spelled out, .com.
Wonderful. And Debbie, it's such a thrill to have you on the show, and thanks for all the great work you do with your writing and your good advice.
Oh, Denise, thank you. You are a star, and I'm just flattered to have been invited. It's been a great experience. Thank you.
All right, folks. That's it for This Week in Law, and we'll catch you next time. Take care.